This is Common Ground. In this edition of Common Ground, the economy of Thailand is changing, carrying widespread repercussions.
Well, the government policies have clearly been laissez-faire, so therefore investors have an opportunity to reap substantial profits in light manufacturing without a lot of the bearing the social costs.
And then later in the program, training environmentalists from around the world.
We're hoping that these are people who will be out there on the front lines dealing with conservation issues in their countries in the future.
Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It is produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Jeff Martin. From the standpoint of foreign investors and many local people, Thailand is an Asian success story. The once poor country has enjoyed economic expansion, averaging 11% for the past few years. But critics say Thai workers have not fully shared in the country's economic expansion. Reese Ehrlich files this report from Bangkok.
Much of Bangkok is splattered with fancy high-rise office buildings, but in this industrial section, roosters and chickens scurry down a narrow road. Garment workers live here in a dormitory consisting of 8 by 8 foot individual rooms, a communal kitchen and bathroom. They usually work 78-hour weeks to earn $200 per month. One woman struggles in English to explain what that means.
They work 5 until 10 in the morning.
At night.
And they come back to towards close. Mm-hmm. And they will sleep around 1 o'clock, but 1 p.m. another day. Midnight, every day, like this.
So that's a hard life.
Yeah.
Hard life. Garment worker Sombun Lubcharyon washes some rice before preparing the evening meal. She's a sewing machine operator at a Hong Kong-owned company that makes women's underwear sold widely in the U.S. She and some fellow workers sit cross-legged on the floor of her room to talk about their lives. An overhead fan beats at the languid air.
We feel very tired. We can't even wake up in the morning because we have no energy left. But we have to go to work. We can't show the boss that we're tired. The employer says we're lazy, but we're just tired from so much work. Working conditions are very bad. The factory is very dirty. We breathe cotton dust all the time.
Sombun says the workers at her factory well remember the 1993 catered toy factory fire in Bangkok, in which nearly 200 workers died, the worst industrial fire in world history.
If there was a fire, we couldn't get out right away. The aisles are very narrow. Boxes are all over the place. We're very worried about our safety if there was another accident like Cater. The company is building a new factory, but construction can be very shoddy. We're not sure if it will be safe.
For the past 20 years, garment, textile, and similar labor-intensive industries have been the backbone of Thailand's economic expansion. The country has seen the growth of a new entrepreneurial business class, closely linked with the military and political governing elite. Foreign investors have profited as well. So the government trumpets the benefits of free enterprise capitalism, but Sombun has a different perspective.
The government wants Thailand to become an industrialized country. Businessmen have expanded a lot of factories and want a lot of income. This policy does a lot to support the businessmen, but the government doesn't do anything for the workers. their social welfare or safety. Workers should get themselves together and build up unions to improve their living conditions.
Workers at this garment factory did exactly that. They recently unionized and elected Sambun as their local president. Some conditions improved immediately, including a halt to arbitrary firings. But the union is only a few months old, and Sambun expects many battles ahead to improve workers' lives. Professor Le Dilokvidharat, chair of the Labor and Management Development Center at a local university, says conditions at Sambun's plant are typical for many industries. He says the Thai government's solution to low wages is to encourage investment in sophisticated factories that add more value to the products.
Let's say the people are in the mood that we have to shift from our labor-intensive industry to the higher value-added industry, because we could no longer compete with the newly open countries which has cheaper labor cost, such as the China, Vietnam, or even Indonesia. So if we go on competing with them in the lower value-added product, we will be defeated.
Over the past 5 years, Thai leaders have encouraged investment in the computer sector, and nowhere is the result more clear than at Seagate Technologies, a California-based maker of disk drives, the memory of computers.
สวัสดีค่ะ Seagate ค่ะ.
Here at Seagate's main Bangkok factory, secretaries can answer the phone in either Thai or English. The company has 26,000 workers in 5 factories, making it Thailand's largest private employer. Seagate's wages and benefits surpass those of many Thai-owned companies. Senior production manager Ongkorn Pattaparkasan proudly shows off the area where hundreds of women dressed in immaculate white uniforms assemble the disk drives. The rooms are clean and air-conditioned because the parts must be protected from even the tiniest speck of dust.
Is this the same standards as in the United States in terms of cleanliness?
Yes.
Yes. So conditions for the workers must be very safe.
Yes.
Yes.
Seagate officials say that their Thai and American factories have the same health and safety standards, but that's not what some Thai workers and an occupational health professional say. They charge that Seagate maintains dangerous manufacturing processes that would never be tolerated in the U.S. At a busy hospital in Bangkok, Dr. Oraphun Metadilokul steps into her small, crowded office. She's president of the Occupational and Environmental Medicine Association of Thailand, a society of medical specialists. In 1991, Dr. Oraphun was part of a government team sent to test nearly 1,200 Seagate workers. Dr. Oraphun found dangerously high levels of lead in the blood of some workers. She says employees soldering and working with solvents showed symptoms of toxic poisoning. Since that time, she has treated over 200 Seagate workers for occupational illnesses. Dr. Oraphun.
In my opinion, the lead poisoning continued. I haven't been in the one factory for 4 years, but I continue to treat many patients from there. Most of them have the same problems as 4 years ago. Seagate has never accepted responsibility for the illnesses, even when we find the lead level in the blood is very high and workers have all the symptoms of chronic lead poisoning, including dizziness and disorientation.
Dr. Oraphun says occupational illness is the hidden cost of Thailand's future economic growth.
I think Thai workers are not treated like humans. As these industries expand, their health will get worse, but they won't know it for many years. They're going to be cheated because they're told this is very high tech, but they're not told about the harmful chemicals. This will affect not only the workers, but their children, because some of these chemicals will affect the unborn fetus. We shouldn't accept all these dirty processes that are called high tech.
Despite repeated requests, Seagate officials both in Thailand and in California refused to comment on tape, citing a company policy of not wanting their voices to be heard in the broadcast media. However, Lee Khoury, Senior Director for Environmental Health and Safety, explained Seagate's views in a non-recorded interview. He says non-Seagate doctors tested workers at every location in the disputed factory and found no signs of lead or solvent poisoning. Khoury says a Thai workers' compensation court ruled in Seagate's favor in the two cases to come to trial so far. Many more cases are going through the workers' comp system. Khoury says the Thai Ministry of Health investigated the plant and reported that Seagate's safety procedures were fine. However, according to some experts, a clean bill of health from Thai agencies may not be worth much. Economist Peter Gajewski is a consultant for the Agency for International Development. He says labor, safety, and health laws in Thailand are rarely enforced.
Well, the government policies have clearly been laissez-faire in terms of allowing foreign investment to come in. Not being restrictive in terms of what kind of domestic investment can take place, restrictive in the sense that they do not apply any labor standards. There are almost no environmental regulations that are implemented. So therefore, investors have an opportunity to reap substantial profits in light manufacturing without a lot of the bearing the social costs.
Jadid Chuvalai does social work with Seagate assembly line workers through the nonprofit Friends of Women Foundation. He says Seagate is only one of many companies in Thailand that have dangerous working conditions. Several years ago, Seagate workers tried to form a union. Jadid urges Seagate and other corporations to allow the workers to organize.
Comparing American and other companies, investors claim they're better, but the working conditions are the same. For example, there are bad conditions at Seagate, but the company won't allow workers to unionize. Companies must respect the basic rights of workers. They must set up better standards to improve working conditions. They must not only consider production, but the workers' quality of life.
Seagate officials say their Thai workers are free to unionize, but have chosen not to because they are happy with their wages and working conditions. Economist Peter Gajewski stares out of his high-rise office at the clogged Bangkok traffic. He used to work for the Thai government and has lived here for over 20 years. Gajewski says Thailand has made tremendous economic progress, but not everyone has benefited equally.
The economy, of course, has transformed itself from a predominantly agriculture economy to now a predominantly service and manufacturing economy. The benefits, however, from the investments in service and manufacturing have mainly gone to the upper income groups, the upper 20%, whereas the real incomes of labor, or let's say the 60% income percentile, have maybe increased by two times in the last 30 years, whereas the GDP has increased much more than that.
Gajewski says Thai government and business leaders should start thinking about the long-term impact of their economic policies.
I think clearly you're going to have economic growth continue at the 8% average over the next 5 years, while at the same time it's going to further eat into the social and environmental infrastructure. But there's still enough room for expansion to occur at that rate, but the costs are going to be higher and higher each year in terms of environmental degradation, income distribution, and just overall congestion of the economy.
Economist Gajewski says the Thai government should put far more money into education, health and infrastructure, and allow unions to develop. If the government doesn't reduce poverty and increase the workers' standard of living, social discontent will almost certainly grow. For Common Ground, I'm Reese Ehrlich.
When Common Ground continues, museums aren't just exhibits. A prominent Chicago museum is playing an important role in environmental education for people around the world. Printed transcripts of Common Ground and audio cassettes of this program are available from Journal Graphics. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts varied programs and activities meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. Conservation biologists from around the world are going to Chicago to learn the latest techniques for protecting their natural environment. Keith Porter has the story.
Distribution, and this very handsome frog is a narrow-mouthed frog.
Another in a classroom at Chicago's Field Museum, the advanced training program in the conservation of biological diversity carries on. The program is a joint effort of the museum, the University of Illinois at Chicago, and the Chicago Zoological Society, operators of the Brookfield Zoo. Dr. Wendy Jackson is program coordinator.
What is perhaps unique about our program is that it's targeting professionals who have positions in their own countries that they will be able to return to and make use of the information that they've gained here in Chicago immediately. They will be able to have an immediate impact once they return. There are programs that bring students to the United States to either receive master's degrees or PhDs, but there the impact, although it will eventually be significant, is more delayed. There are also programs here for people who are sort of one level down, working as wildlife managers, rangers, to teach them techniques for the field techniques, essentially. And what we're training here are people who are university lecturers, museum curators, program officers for non-governmental organizations, people who work in government agencies at a higher level, although still early in their careers, so they'll be able to actually implement what they've learned here.
Most of the people who are able to leave the tropical countries are either very high-level government officials who are a long way from the front lines, in effect, and aren't in a position to be able to pass their knowledge on to other people very effectively because they have so many other responsibilities. Or they're people who come to the U.S. for anywhere from 3 to 6 years of graduate study. And those are generally not people who have jobs waiting for them.
Dr. Larry Haney of the Field Museum is project director.
So what we've done is to select people who are young professionals who already have good jobs, but have them involved in work that have to do with conservation issues. Who are working with students or working with lots of colleagues, who they can then pass their new knowledge on to very quickly and very effectively. The impact of that, we hope, will be to have this information get out very quickly, to have it have the greatest impact possible in the shortest amount of time. The reason why that is so important is that in many of these countries, the environmental problems are quite serious at this point. There needs to be action taken right now. The people are there to do it. All of these folks are very bright, very hardworking, very capable. But their exposure to the kinds of resources that we take for granted here is extremely limited. Many of them have not ever seen a good library. In fact, some of them have barely seen a library at all. Most of them have never seen a well-equipped laboratory of any sort. They've never seen a modern research-oriented zoo or museum. And so in many cases, they simply don't know what the options are. And so what we're trying to do with the program is to give them options, give them the intellectual tools that they can use to be more effective, and in a larger sense, to promote leadership. We're hoping that these are people who will be out there on the front lines dealing with conservation issues in their countries in the future.
Many of the past participants that I'd read about, at least, reported that that they felt awful alone back at home, and that this program in some ways helped to alleviate that. Can you explain why they feel so alone?
Oh, sure. In many of the countries, communication is very, very limited between institutions and outside of the country. And so the few people who are interested in trying to deal with issues in conservation end up really having very, very few other people to talk to. They're particularly with these younger people who are the ones who are out there doing the field work and seeing the problems. They're not high enough up in the bureaucracy to be selected to go to conferences. And yet they're the ones who are actually out there trying to deal with the problems. And so when they come here, one of the most important things that happens is that they have a chance to talk with each other and find out that they share the same problems, and they start finding out how the other people are solving the same problems and doing it with a technology and at a level that is appropriate for them.
I'm learning new things. I'm learning from the experience of other people whom I wouldn't have met if I hadn't come, so that's something.
One of the participants, Eseza Kaukudidi, is a university lecturer in Uganda.
We are being introduced to issues that, you know, we didn't know about. I didn't know about in my country that they happened, but they are worldwide, and so I'm affected. So I'm getting something new, which I wouldn't have got.
What are the particular conservation issues that most concern you in Uganda?
The use of plants by the indigenous people is one of the issue, because they depend on them, and yet they are depleting them from their sources. So that's an issue that needs to be attended to, and I hope I'll be able to help many to get to know how they can use them sustainably.
I know that some past participants I'd read about said that they felt sort of alone back at home, that there weren't many people who cared about the same or had the same convictions that they do. Do you ever feel that way back in Uganda?
Yes and no. There are many who are interested. But one of the problems I find is that we are not communicating. And I will try my best to see that we communicate.
Not represented in the northern parts of Eurasia. But here we have a frog of a lineage.
Today's lecture on frog diversity comes to the students from one of the world's leading experts on this topic, Dr. Bob Enger, curator emeritus of the Field Museum. Dr. Enger is a big fan of the advanced training program.
I think it's wonderful. For one thing, people who live in tropical countries, by and large, are isolated from people who are doing the same kind of work, even in the neighboring countries. And for these people to get together to talk with one another is at least as important as the information they may get from people like me, or Larry, or Wendy, or even from their reading.
Today you were talking about frogs in Borneo. What was the idea that you were trying to get across to these students today?
Well, what do we mean by biodiversity? We don't mean just a list of names on a piece of paper. We're talking about diversity in just about umpteen different dimensions. And the fact is that the comparison between, let's say, Bornean frog fauna and the Illinois frog fauna is not simply in terms of the number of species or the number of families represented, but the diversity in modes of life as well. And it's important to think of biodiversity in that way, because if we're really interested in conservation, we have to attune our conservation methods to those modes of life. It's not just numbers of species. We've got to know, for conservation to be effective, the methods employed have to be appropriate to particular species. So you have to start out with understanding the diversity of a fauna. I get a little tired, I have to say, of the flagship species concept in conservation. We're going to save the giant panda. That really doesn't interest me very much anymore. I don't want to see the giant panda go extinct or a tiger go extinct, but I'd like to see us save a large segment of an animal community, a whole fauna. And that means that you have to learn something about the biology of a lot of species.
One final question for you. You've certainly been here a long time. What has changed about the role of places like the Field Museum that now allows them to do a program like this advanced training program? Is there something different, something that has changed in the way museums are run and how they view their mission?
It's not how museums are run that's changed. What has changed is the research interests of curators. Curators at this museum were always interested in natural history as a general topic. Most of them were good naturalists from the very beginning. But now more of us are working on aspects of community ecology that become important to the field of conservation. And another thing that has happened, and this is a real sociological, political change. We can't just go anywhere in the world we want and do whatever we want. In the past, if a curator wanted to go to Brazil to collect, he just went. That's it. As long as he had the money to do it, he just went. Now, when you go to a tropical country to work, you have to get permission to work. And just as a foreigner coming to this country has to have permission. Furthermore, your chances of gaining permission are greatly increased if you're working with somebody from that country. Most of us, Larry and myself, for example, have always been involved in training local people. I hire a couple of local men to work with me, and before you know it, they know an awful lot about the biology of frogs. They may be on the staff of, let's say, Saba Parks, the park administration of the northern part of Borneo. Well, after I leave, they go on with their work. But if they're, let's say, responsible for leading nature walks, they can talk to the people on those walks about the biology of frogs as well as about the orchids that grow there. They can also do their own research after I leave. Well, this course is, you know, part and parcel of the same kind of activity. And it's our change in research interests and the change in the social political structure, climate of the world, that has now made this, a course like this, much more likely and appropriate.
Dr. Bob Enger is Curator Emeritus of the Field Museum in Chicago, home of the Advanced Training Program in the Conservation of Biological Diversity. For Common Ground, I'm Keith Porter.
For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9540, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9540. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you would like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or if you have some comments about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. For Common Ground, I'm Jeff Martin. BJ Lederman created our theme music. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.